Good evening, everyone. I'm Linor Mudu. Welcome to Health Chat. Radiology is recognized as a key component of modern healthcare. X-rays and CT scans are critical to diagnose and treat a variety of diseases. However, according to the World Health Organization, approximately 3 to 4 billion people around the world are at risk for widespread losses and deaths that can be avoided or treated if radiology were available. I discussed radiology with Dr. Frank Minja. He's Director of Neuroradiology, MRI, and Assistant Professor of Neuroradiology at Yale University. He spoke of the challenges of access to radiology in Africa and how they can be addressed. Take a listen. Dr. Frank Minja, thank you so much for joining us on Voice of America.
Thank you for having me.
We hear about X-ray. We know that it's really an important part of the health system. But tell us a little more about radiology.
So radiology is a branch of medicine where we actually interpret any medical images. So there are many ways of taking pictures of the human body. So X-ray and ultrasound are probably the most common ways that people have heard about. But you can also have CT scans and MRI scans. But basically all of these technologies are a way of basically looking inside the human body and being able to diagnose diseases. And so what the radiologist does is basically interprets those pictures. So once the pictures come, we are trained to actually look at the images, interpret the images, and basically try to decide what kind of disease. For example, whether a person has a fracture, or whether a person has cancer, whether the cancer is responding to treatment, or whether a person has an infection, and so forth.
When does someone need an X-ray as opposed to an MRI versus a CT scan? How do you differentiate that?
Absolutely. So it really depends on how the patient presents, meaning like what symptoms do they have. And the other thing is that these different technologies have different strengths. For example, X-ray is very good about detecting fractures. So X-ray and CT, even CT scan is an X-ray-based technology. So those technologies are very good at detecting problems with the bones. So if somebody had trauma, whether it was a motorcycle accident, CT scan and X-rays are very good technologies for that. For example, if it's a more of a soft tissue, so let's say you're worried about somebody having cancer, somebody having an infection, or somebody wanting to check their pregnancy and seeing how the pregnancy is progressing, ultrasound and MRI are far more suited for that. And the other point is that ultrasound and MRI do not have radiation. So when we are worried about exposing the patient to radiation, especially females who are pregnant or younger children, we'll prefer to do ultrasound and MRI and sort of spare them from using the radiation that is delivered by X-rays. So it does depend on the patient population and what the clinical question is.
When you look at how far medicine has gone with radiology, and you working in the United States, of course, it's available, but as an African, what can you tell us?
So unfortunately, in the African context, things are still quite dire. And I would say that, we were struggling a lot with the availability of the technology. So beyond X-rays and ultrasound, the CT scans and MRI scans are actually quite expensive. And so most countries, hospitals may not have the facility. But I would say the even bigger problem is the lack of trained specialists. And that is an area that I have a lot of passion about. So Tanzania specifically, we have only 70 radiologists for a population of 60 million people. So literally you're having about one radiologist for a population of 1 million people. And that is clearly not sufficient, where the recommendation is close to about 100 radiologists for a population of 1 million. So we have 100-fold to go. And so I would say many countries now are beginning to understand that the machines and the technology needs to be purchased, but still we are lagging far behind in training opportunities and training of the specialists. And we have a lot of efforts to try and address that specific need.
You studied to become a specialized radiologist, but is it something that you can train even a nurse to know the basics?
This is the issue about whether we can do task shifting. So I think at very basic studies, let's say the X-ray is about fracture and so forth, you may be able to train non-MD physicians to do that basic interpretation. But once we start to get into what we call cross-sectional imaging, which is the CT scans and MRIs, I think you need a certain level of expertise, and it wouldn't be helpful to train all medical cadres to interpret those images. And even here in the United States, where we have the capacity, they're still interpreted at a pretty high level, and people need the specialized training for it. So I think there is a role at the basic level, but once you start getting a little bit more advanced, I would advocate for more specialized training programs.
What work are you trying to do in terms of bringing back to the continent, particularly in Tanzania?
There are still many, many opportunities in terms of providing the services. So, for example, radiology, we are fortunate that the images are digital and they can travel. So, meaning the same way on WhatsApp we can share pictures, there are platforms for us to share medical images electronically. So I think, like, for example, Africans in the diaspora may be able to lend a hand in actually providing the service. And many times I will be asked to consult and give like a second opinion on the images. And so we're happy to do that. So I think that avenues for provision of the service, whether it's pro bono basis or whether building what we call teleradiology platforms and investing in those to sort of stop gap that measure, meaning a patient has the CT scan performed in Tanzania, but somebody anywhere in the world would have access to interpret and offer an opinion on that or a second opinion on that. So I think there's bridging between the service provision and the training aspect. So immediately, yes, we can offer more in terms of service provision, but I think long term, we do have to offer training opportunities.
Speaking of the role of the diaspora, there is this. This is the second year that the Tanzanian diaspora is organizing an event to kind of raise awareness and support. Talk to us about the significance of this event and what is expected.
Thank you so much for that question. We have a Mobilize for Health forum. It's our second time we're doing this health forum. And this is trying to, again, galvanize the Tanzanian diaspora to get more involved in the healthcare sector in Tanzania. So when we did the health forum back in 2017, we discovered that there are actually many, many Tanzanian diasporas are doing like fantastic things in the healthcare arena, but we don't know each other. We don't know, sometimes we're in the same hospital at different times. And so the first thing was just coordinating and knowing who's doing what. And so in this particular forum, we're actually excited that we actually want to bring in more new voices that we have not heard before, but also just expand the diaspora involvement in general. So we'll find that many times the diaspora is more versed in like basic healthcare issues, and they can help to educate the general population. So for example, things like vaccination, the importance of vaccination. So any diaspora, they don't have to be a physician or a nurse or a healthcare practitioner to be able to help educate their community about the importance of vaccination, because they see the benefit of vaccination in their own community. And I think our message is that basically all of us in the diaspora have a role to play in the healthcare arena, because a lot of the healthcare gains are really around education and less so the hospital-based care, which, you know, it is needed when somebody is sick, but 90% of healthcare is really about how people access healthcare, when do they access healthcare, and general knowledge in general.
Dr. Minja, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for the opportunity.
And that was Dr. Frank Minja, Director of Neuroradiology, MRI, and Assistant Professor of Neuroradiology at Yale University. Now, breast cancer is the most common cancer in women worldwide, and early detection saves lives. Scientists are working on finding new ways to detect breast cancer, while at the same time, they are studying existing screening methods, including medical imaging, to find out what is best. VOA's Carol Pearson reports.
During a mammogram, a technician takes an X-ray of a woman's breast that's compressed between two glass plates. A radiologist then examines the image for tumors. Mammograms undoubtedly save lives. The number of deaths from breast cancer has fallen by 30% in the U.S. since mammography was introduced in the 1970s. That's because when cancer is found early, the chances of beating it are greater. Mammograms are the best screening tools available, but they aren't 100% accurate. A mammogram can look normal even when cancer is present, and it can look abnormal even though there's no cancer in the breast at all. Standard mammograms are two-dimensional, but for the 40 to 50% of women with dense breasts, both tumors and breast tissue can show up as white masses on 2D images. Three-dimensional mammograms show a more detailed view of the breast, so women with fibrous or dense breasts may benefit from a 3D screening, says Dr. Otis Brawley at the American Cancer Society.
It might find disease that we need to find that two-dimensional does not. There are potential cons in that it has a higher cost, higher amount of radiation given every dose, every time a person has the test, as well as it may find a higher number of false positives.
Cost aside, one study involving 13 U.S. hospitals showed that three-dimensional mammograms picked up an additional 40% of invasive cancers. For an even better picture, a woman could have an automated whole breast ultrasound. During this procedure, a woman lies on her back as the ultrasound device moves in parallel rows, so no areas of the breast are missed. The exam captures between 3,000 and 5,000 images that are then interpreted by a radiologist. Dr. Megha Garg is the director of the breast imaging program at the University of Missouri Cancer Center.
This is a new screening technique. It helps detect additional breast cancers in females who have got dense breasts.
The whole breast ultrasound doesn't use radiation, so it poses less of a risk than a mammogram does. But Garg says it's not time to ditch the standard mammogram.
This tool does not replace the traditional mammogram. Mammograms are the gold standard for finding breast cancer. This helps the mammogram in those females who have got dense breasts.
Studies are underway to find out which techniques are the most effective. While North America, Western Europe, and Australia have the highest rates of breast cancer, the World Health Organization reports that almost 50% of the cases and nearly 60% of the deaths occur in less developed countries. If we could improve detection and treatment, at least 400,000 women's lives could be saved every year. Carol Pearson, VOA News, Washington.
Well, it's time to take a short break. Don't go away. We'll be right back.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, the International Day for the Disabled Persons is commemorated on December 3rd. Disability on the continent on the next Straight Talk Africa.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
VOA's Our Voices television program is about more than just sitting and talking about women's issues.
It's about listening to them
and bringing their opinions to the table and making sure that their voices are heard. Because our lived experiences, our stories, and our voices will help shape the next generation.
Check your local TV listings and join the conversation each week with Our Voices on VOA.
Border Crossings.
Join host Larry London.
Larry London.
On Border Crossings, VOA's only worldwide music request hour.
Whoa.
Every weekday at 1500 Universal. Tune in for the biggest hits and amazing artists. Win prizes and get the latest news from exclusive celebrity interviews.
Ooh.
Send your requests to Facebook at VOA Larry London, Twitter at Border Crossings, or Instagram at Border Crossings VOA. Or call 202-619-2077 and have your favorite music played to the entire world.
Ah.
Don't miss Border Crossings every weekday at 1500 Universal, only on The Voice of America.
Welcome back to Health Chat. We turn now to HIV/AIDS. When AIDS was first named some 40 plus years ago, it was a death sentence. Since then, with education and advancements in science, it has become a disease that some 40 million people live with. The yearly World AIDS Day observance every December 1st is a way to make people realize AIDS is still with us. And despite advances, the epidemic week isn't over. Once again, here is VOA's Carol Pearson.
Communities around the world observe World AIDS Day with messages about awareness and prevention. The simplest method is always to use a condom during sex. In 2004, when health ministers first designated December 1st as World AIDS Day, they realized that, unlike other diseases, the HIV virus that causes AIDS could spread globally. Paul Kawada has been an AIDS activist since the very beginning, when people with AIDS died horrible deaths. He is still in the fight at NMAC, an organization formerly known as the National Minority AIDS Council.
And I was there in the early days. I was there when we both had to fight back and act out and also bury so many people that we loved.
Dr. Anthony Fauci has also been in the fight since the beginning. Fauci has been the director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Disease since 1984. He's been involved in the development of treatments for HIV. Treatment is now so effective that if an infected person takes one pill a day, it's impossible to pass the virus to anyone else. 7 years ago, another drug became available that prevents uninfected people from getting the disease. It's called Truvada. Fauci says ending AIDS could be simple.
If you did those two things, treatment as prevention for those who are infected, pre-exposure prophylaxis for those who are at risk, if you implemented that to its fullest, theoretically you could end the epidemic just like that.
AIDS-related deaths are now down by more than 55% since the peak, but it's still with us. Kawada says gaps in treatment are the main reason.
We have to understand that HIV sits at the intersection of so much discrimination and stigma. First of all, it impacts predominantly people of color. Number two, it impacts predominantly gay men. Number three, it impacts predominantly poor people.
The majority of people with HIV in the U.S. are poor. The majority of people with HIV outside the U.S. live in low and middle-income countries. Teenagers everywhere are at risk. They have little access to testing, health care, and counseling. And that's why Fauci says we need something else besides medication.
We're not going to eliminate HIV without a vaccine.
Fauci says the work on vaccines is promising. But right now, the best tools are still getting people tested, getting those who are positive on therapy, and getting those at risk of becoming infected on therapeutics, and treating HIV as a disease, not as a political or moral or social issue. Carol Pearson, VOA News, Washington.
Botswana has started offering free antiretroviral therapy to foreign sex workers following a decision to extend treatment to non-citizens. An estimated 30,000 foreigners living in Botswana are HIV positive, and most are sex workers. Until now, the Southern African nation was one of only few countries that did not offer treatment to non-citizens. From Gaborone, Botswana, Nkondisi Dube has more.
In January, Botswana's government was dragged to court by a major ARV supplier, citing irregularities in the awarding of a contract for the provision of the drugs. The company, Portfolio Pharmaceuticals, managed to win a ruling at the High Court halting the supply of ARVs until the resolution of the matter. The move sparked a countrywide shortage of the critical drug, which the government said had left thousands of lives at risk. On Friday, the country's Court of Appeal overturned the lower court's judgment in favor of the government. Wedumelo Malata, who is HIV positive, says he's elated by the court's decision, saying it has been a nightmare to get the drugs.
If I could tell you how I've been living for the past few months, it's really been devastating, because you can imagine I don't have as much funds to be able to travel back and forth to hospitals to get medication. I'm happy now that things will go back to normal.
In passing judgment, the president of the Court of Appeal, Ian Kebby, criticized the lower court's decision, saying it was a matter of life and death. The Botswana Network on Ethics, Law and HIV Bonela director, Cindy Kelemi, says the case should serve as a reminder to the government to review its procurement processes.
One of the weaknesses we identified as an organization is that government had entered into an exclusive contract. In our view, we cannot enter into an exclusive contract if we are dealing with essential drugs such as ARVs.
Botswana's Minister of Health Permanent Secretary Ruth Maphorisa says vital lessons have been learned and supply processes will be reviewed.
In the long term, given the experiences that we have had as a ministry, we have a plan of ensuring that there's adequate supply at any given time, and it's a policy matter that we want to take a stand on.
Botswana has the third highest HIV prevalence in the world, but has been widely lauded for its effort to fight the scourge. The drawn-out case was threatening to reverse gains as some patients were reported to be in danger of skipping treatment. Mkondisi Dube for VOA News, Gaborone, Botswana.
VOA Africa has built a successful, effective social media strategy through Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, and other digital platforms. We are responding to our audience on the African continent and in the global diaspora. We believe in the power of connection and interaction to bring you news that is comprehensive, accurate, and objective. We see the changes in technology as an opportunity to engage with our audiences about the issues that affect them. At VOA Africa, we don't just report the news, we help shape the conversation on the continent. VOA, your trusted source for news and information.
Now let's go to Kenya. Recently, the country hosted the United Nations Coordinated International Conference on Population and Development, with over 6,000 delegates focusing on reproductive health rights, ending gender-based violence, and sustainable development. The three-day conference was first held in Cairo 25 years ago, where more than 150 countries adopted a plan of action for women's empowerment. The summit provides a platform for governments and institutions to amplify gains made since the first convention and to reiterate promises and make commitments toward the ICPD's agenda.
The UN's International Conference on Population and Development opened Tuesday with repeated vows made at the first summit in Cairo 25 years ago. Crown Princess Mary of Denmark, a co-host of the conference, underscored the significance of the summit.
I think we can all agree that ICPD was a turning point, a defining moment in our history. In Cairo, the world articulated a bold new vision about the relationship between population, development, and individual well-being, and the empowering of women and meeting people's needs for education and health, including sexual and reproductive health, are necessary for both individual advancement and balanced development.
The summit aims to examine the progress made since a 1994 program of action drafted in Cairo. More than 150 countries signed on to the plan, which placed women's empowerment, individual dignity, and human rights, and the right to plan one's family at the heart of development. In Nairobi Tuesday, heads of state stressed their country's policies and commitments to gender equality, sexual and reproductive health. Kenya's President Uhuru Kenyatta pledged to end female genital mutilation by 2022. Kenyatta was among African leaders who called also for ending child marriage.
I believe that we can all commit to eliminate child marriages. The percentage of young women between 20 and 24 years of age who are married before their 18th birthday has declined from 34% in 1994 to 25% in 2019. But the absolute number of girls under 18 who are at risk of child marriages is estimated at 10.3 million in 2019.
Child marriage and sexual and reproductive health care are controversial issues in African nations where traditional cultures often clash with campaigns for individual rights. In some countries like Kenya, laws that limit access to abortion services have fueled unsafe, often deadly backstreet abortions. At the conference Tuesday, the UN's Deputy Secretary General Amina Mohammed tied women's rights squarely to development.
The power to choose the number, timing, and spacing of children is a human right that can bolster well-being, economic, and social development. And when people can exercise their rights, they thrive, and they do, and so do societies at large.
To reach those goals, the Nairobi Conference on Population and Development is expected to produce pledges of financial support. But it will take more than money and talk to see some African nations enforce laws and regulations on gender equality and sexual and reproductive health. Raya Lombard for VOA News, Nairobi.
Now, to Malawi, the founder of a Malawian maternity clinic for poor women says it has set a record delivering more than 8,800 babies with not a single death to a mother or child. For her efforts improving access to safe childbirth, Charity Salima has become known as Malawi's Florence Nightingale, the English founder of modern nursing. Lamek Masina has the details from Lilongwe.
Grace Chakudza gave birth in November to a healthy baby boy, her fourth child, at Achikondi Community Clinic. It opened in 2008 to help poor women safely give birth. Since then, the clinic has performed more than 8,800 successful deliveries without the loss of a mother or a child, according to its founder. That's a record number in Malawi, where the United Nations Children's Fund says the average mortality rate per 1,000 births is 22 deaths for babies and 6 for mothers. Chakudza appreciates the care she got from the clinic. She says there is a big difference. There is congestion in public hospitals. Women give birth on the floor, and sometimes one nurse is responsible for 3 pregnant mothers. This compromises the health of mothers and children. But here, I received good treatment. The number of successful deliveries reported by the clinic means it beats not only the global average of 17 newborn deaths per 1,000 births, but also the average of rich nations. Britain this year gave clinic founder Charity Salima the Commonwealth Points of Light Award, calling her Malawi's Florence Nightingale, the English founder of modern nursing. Salima credits the way the clinic handles the medical emergencies.
All that success has come in because we can live where there is a complication as soon as possible. Early detection of any abnormality and any referral. That is what makes us to be successful.
The clinic is free of charge, and the building, constructed by donations from Scotland and the Norwegian Nurses Organization. The US-based charity Freedom from Fistula Foundation, which helps treat the childbirth injury, funds the clinic. Lita Kaunda is the community leader at Area 23, where the clinic is situated. She says before this clinic, many pregnant mothers were giving birth on their way to the hospital because of the distance they were traveling. Despite their reputation, Salima says the clinic does have challenges.
Sometimes we lack resources. It could be financial resources. We don't have much resources. We would also want if we could have this building, like have a solar electricity, because sometimes electricity is on and off.
Salima hopes the clinic will get additional support and do even more to reduce Malawi's newborn and maternal deaths. Lamek Masina for VOA News, Lilongwe.
And that's all the time we have for this edition of Health Chat. Thank you for joining us today. We thank our guest, Dr. Frank Minja, for sitting down with us. And thanks to all of our affiliates. I'm your host, Lenore Mudu in Washington, with producer Dan Brown. Until next time, take care, be well, and strive to make every day a healthy day.
This is VOA News.